Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today I am really happy to bring back Jeff Sturgeon, who's a very talented artist, and the always entertaining fan favorite producer writer Stephen L. Sears. Hi, Steve. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
How you doing, Sherry?
I'm fine. Well, you wanted to do the favorite part. I had the other part in.
I wish I could get your intros on my resume.
Really? I was thinking the same thing. Quite an opening.
You could have like a little little clip on your resume. Here, listen to this link.
Exactly. Everything's digital and video now.
And it's weird.
We might have to,
the first time I ever auditioned with a link, I didn't even know what I was doing. It's a very strange world we live in now.
That is a true thing. In fact, as we were prepping to come on the air, for those of you who just joined us, we have about 10 minutes where we actually panic and say, oh, my God, what are we going to talk about? While we were doing that, I was actually printing out a script that I have to go through and putting Brad's on it, and I realized that about 10 years ago, I would buy stacks and stacks and reams of three-hole punch paper because I had to send out scripts. Now I don't think I have used three-hole paper more than twice in the last year. Everything's digital.
And it's kind of sad. Real script is nice.
Yeah, but it's not that sad if you're a tree. So.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, we're saving trees doing it this way.
The same thing with art as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Jeff, because you've gone through every medium up to digital, right?
The internet.
Well, we talked over
one question at a time.
Yeah, I know. Because of that delay, we talk over. But I'm not going to hijack Sherry's show. But that brings up an interesting question because your artwork, you're an amazing artist. I'm not saying that as your friend. I was attracted to your artwork before we even talked. But you go back. I'm not going to age you, but you go back pretty far, way before the digital medium. And I run into a lot of artists today, especially in graphic novels, that have some of them have never even picked up a brush pen. You know, everything they've done is digital.
Yeah, I see that quite a bit. Well, you know, a lot of young artists approach me at the shows and the conventions, and I'll do portfolio reviews sometimes, and everything. Of course, everything's on their pads now, their phones. Which is cool, but yeah, it's changed so much since I came up in the 80s as a fan artist way back and was one of the first artists hired into the computer game business in 1990. It was that first wave of artists. So I saw the digital thing from the very beginning, art-wise.
It is pretty amazing. I mean, sadly for someone like me, I can't hang your iPad on my wall. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It's like, you want to buy an original? Sure, I'll print it out. What?
I do a lot of shows, and I see a lot of digital art. And some of it's very cool, and some of it's not. But there's still some of us that paint traditionally, though I paint kind of untraditionally because I paint on aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And I still do some digital stuff as well. But it's everywhere.
You've kept up with the times.
Try to.
I do have a question, because it's all done, you know, today digitally, but you still paint. How do you, if you create a beautiful piece, how do you transfer it to digital? I mean, do you take a picture of it? I'm kind of confused.
Right. I do covers. You know, I do book covers and prints, so I do my own photography. The thing with I've got a nice studio. I'm in right now. But with the metal, the aluminum's so crazy that we have to light it different ways. We'll move the lights up and down and back and forth. And every time we move them, there's a different effect with the metal. And it gets hot real quick, a film term where the metal gets too bright. And so we take, you know, I'm looking at this, I did a climate painting of Florida 2050, what it might look like in 30 years. And we'll shoot probably 30 or 40 pictures of it. Then I'll go through, I'll transfer them onto my computer, and I'll go through and look at the ones I think might work, and then I'll narrow them down finally to one.
Wow. It sounds like a longer process than actually creating it.
Well, yeah. No. The Florida painting, I've probably got, I don't know, 30 hours in it, 25 hours in the painting.
Wow.
So, you know, the digital part of it, you know, I might take me an hour to go through the shots and, you know, then I'll clean them up a little bit in Photoshop or straighten them. They might be crooked or this, that, and the other. Color and light balance. It's just part of the process.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, go ahead.
Well, other more traditional artists that still paint on canvas or board, they do the same thing, except they, you know, they get the luxury of maybe shooting one out of a couple of shots. They'll have one really good shot because they're easy to photograph, or mine or not.
Mm-hmm. I one of the things I like to do when I go to an art museum and see canvas, and I'm very careful about this. I cover my face so that I'm not breathing on anything. But I'll get close to the canvas and I'll look at it sideways, because what I want to see is actually the peaks and valleys of the paint itself. But I also want to see how the paint has, this will sound weird, how it works with the actual grain of the canvas. And on your artwork, one of the things I've noticed, and it's kind of interesting, I need to go back and take a look at this now that you said that you do straight photography to archive your work as opposed to scanning it, I had noticed that the grain and patterns on aluminum, you use that as well. It's actually a part of many of your paintings.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll take aluminum plate, which is just, you know, it's virgin, it's plate, it's clean. It's, imagine aluminum foil. Well, you've seen aluminum in buildings and just all over the place now, hospitals, et cetera. Well, you know, they've hit a grinder with those things that you're seeing, and I do the same thing. I take the nice, clean aluminum, and I'll go over it with a Makita grinder and create patterns.
Yeah.
And on the smaller things, I'll often just kind of see what comes out of the grind, because they're really cool. And then the bigger pieces, I'll think about what I want to do. And, of course, science fiction things, if it has a galaxy in it, I'll do a galaxy grind.
Mm-hmm. Well, even on there was one painting you did, which I thought was very striking, considering, especially since I live in California, and I'm going to get this totally wrong because I don't remember the title of it. It was one that dealt with the firefighters during the one of our fires.
Right.
And the way
last
you
summer,
ahead. The way you use the aluminum grain on that, and this was one of the first times that it really impressed upon me. God, I hope I'm getting this correctly. The painting, the right side of the painting is the firefighters in the middle of a fire. They're right in the middle of the fire. Then the left side of it is actually very pristine greenery, a little stream. I think you've got volcano with a Mount Shasta. Okay.
Yeah.
And the grain on the greenery side highlighted, it just gave you the feeling of nature. It gave you the feeling of openness and clouds. And then you faded it into the fire where it just got consumed by the smoke and the fire.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy on the right side. Well, thanks, Stephen. I didn't know you'd seen that piece. Yeah, I did it last summer. I grew up in Reading. So it was really, you know, a lot of my friends were out of, you know, they had to be evacuated for 10 days. A couple of my other friends lost everything. A really good friend and artist, Steve Rashad, shout out to Steve, I think he's listening, lost everything. So another friend of mine, Troy Parrott, got a hold of me and came up with an idea for a painting. And so, yeah, the right side is, I think it's on my website or on
actually,
the Art Adjuster.
It's actually part of the banner ad. If you're watching, if you're listening to this and you're watching
cool.
the banner ad,
oh,
about
cool.
halfway through.
Awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, there you go.
So, yeah, and then I donated the painting, the print proceeds to Relief Fund down there for
that's
for those. So, yeah, it's one of those things. Once he instilled the idea real quick, it just took off in my head the way these things do. And so I was in the middle of other things, but I stopped and painted that real quick so I could get it down there.
Well, I remember, I'm down in Southern California, and the closest I've come to that situation was we did back in the late 90s. There was a fire that broke out, a very severe one, near my home, and I was packed up with all my gear ready to evacuate. And I lived on a cul-de-sac in a canyon, so the fire can rush up that canyon at 60 miles an hour, so you got to be ready to go. And it came very, very close. We have some of the best firefighters in the world working here in California. I just, like, love them to death.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I saw that painting, it was like I could almost smell the smoke again. So it's a very, very strong painting. Huh. I didn't know it was on the banner, though.
Well,
that's cool.
I'll send you a print, Stephen.
Oh, that would be awesome. I would love that.
Cool. I remember when I was in college, they called it the Ring of Fire. There was a fire all the way around the San Fernando Valley. The entire valley was cut off. And we were living in Chatsworth. And I was alone.
Yep.
My brother, he went off to look at the fire, which I thought was, he was just 16, but anyway, he went off to look at the fire. My mom and dad were grocery shopping. It was just me and my dog, and I was like, it's getting close. So what I did was I took the hose and my dog, and we went out and hosed the top of the roof. I mean, I was a kid, so what did I know? And then I remembered watching a show that said, take all your valuables and put it in a car just in case you have to evacuate. So I'm going into my mom's room and getting her jewelry box and getting pictures.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Absolutely.
Yep.
I mean, I was just haphazard. And by the time my parents came home, the car was filled with stuff. And my dad goes, we're not evacuating. I go, well, I'm just taking precautions.
Yeah, just in case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it goes quick. Look at what happened to Paradise, which I've driven through many times living in Northern California. It was gone in how many minutes? Just gone.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Once it picks up, the fire feeds itself.
Yep.
And, you know, that's where the term firestorm came from. You know, firestorms have been used in war throughout history. Because they do that once they pick up on themselves. And if a firestorm is the kind that we would see, for example, in the bombings of World War II, literally the winds that would be sucked in to feed the fire were almost hurricane strength. They would blow people into the fire. It was just, okay, we just became very cheerful here, folks. I'm sorry. I just realized. So happy thoughts.
Well, anyway, that was interesting.
Oh my God.
I love him. Knows everything. Well, not everything, but he's a great history buff. He knows a lot about history, so you'll see a lot of that.
Well,
I was honored to do
the painting. To bring it full circle.
There you go.
Okay. But the first time I interviewed you and you sent me your pictures, I just was in awe. Your stuff is just so beautiful. I love it, Jeff.
Thank you, Steve, but you
knew that already. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if Jeff knows it. So.
Well, no. We'll eventually get to the conversation of why we're all on here the same way, but I had the similar reaction to it when I first saw Jeff's work. And those of you should actually look up Jeff and his work, and especially The Last Cities. You have to look that up for a little future reference in this conversation. But it's very exceptional, and quite honestly, it's just the usage of colors and emotions. I think for me, any type of artwork has to move me emotionally. And instantly, if not tell a story, but instantly suggest there's a story to be told. And that's there. That's what Jeff does that very, very well.
I agree.
Thank you, Steve.
I think it's beautiful. I guess I kind of fall into a picture. I love going into museums and just looking at art. And If it's a really strong picture, I'll sit on the bench and just stare at it because I just fall into it. And even though I haven't seen yours in person, I felt that way even though I just saw it on my computer.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah, it's much different in person. The metal, you know, it's one of those things. So it looks, you know, we do the best we can in photographing it and getting the best image I can get, but it's just not the same.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but
it's still
anyway.
Doing good.
Thank you.
I'd like to see it in person. but I don't know. I think art is something that is just it makes you it. It's so, it could take you away on a wave of imagination, or it can make you just rooted into reality like the firefighter picture. I mean, it's really interesting. It's a very powerful thing.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I've done a ton of science fiction and fantasy stuff over the years, hundreds and hundreds of that stuff, and not saying I don't love it, but you get to a point where, or for me anyway, because I've always been very environmentally conscious. I'm an outdoorsman. I fish all the time. I live up here in the Northwest, right on a salmon river. Excuse me. And so, especially climate change and environmental stuff. So I'm doing a series of paintings of what. For instance, this Florida painting is done, what it might look like in 30 years with sea level rise. And I think I posted it on Facebook. You know, half of Florida's gone. So in my painting,
yeah.
I'm looking down on it like from a low orbit kind of view.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm
more into that sort of thing. I'm sorry, Stephen. What?
I said I'm from Florida. So.
What part?
St. Augustine. So my dad retired there after the military. St. Augustine is about 37 miles south of Jacksonville and about 60 miles north of Daytona. So we're on the Atlantic coast.
Right. I see it on my painting, and unfortunately it's underwater.
Yeah, I know. That's okay. We needed to wash out a few things.
Oh, God.
Anyway, I'm concentrating a bit more on that sort of thing.
Gotta wash out a few things.
Well, if you're a fish, it's wonderful.
I was watching.
I get images in my head, these you know painting ideas, and I get them crystal clear. And I'm at a stage in my life and my career where I just I've got to paint them. I got to get them out.
Yeah.
If I can.
Now, do your ideas come to you? Once again, this is a true question for me because I'm trying to make some comparisons here to what I do as a writer. There are two types of, in my experience, there are two basic types of writer. One is a very, very learned writer, and a friend of mine is a good example of that. She'll sit there and stare at the screen, and she's doing chess in her head. She literally is crafting everything as she stares at the screen, and she'll sit there for hours doing this. And the other is what I call the intuitive writer, which is, and I'm in this category, I'll just be playing around with the dog or talking to people or doing something completely insane, and then suddenly I go, oh, sorry, and I'll run off and get to the keyboard, and it just tumbles out at one time.
Right, right.
For artists, what is your category?
It's similar. We're all a little different, too. Can you hear me, everybody?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Since I write as well now, it's definitely a different part of my brain. And for me, it's a lot of thinking about it, the writing part of this thing, which we'll get to in a little bit, the last cities of Earth. So I find myself, because I haven't done a whole lot of that sort of stuff, you know, the plotting and characters and things like we were talking about, Stephen. I find myself staring off a lot and thinking. But my wife tells me I often do that with painting ideas, too. I'll be doing something and just kind of freeze and stare for a few minutes.
Yeah.
And luckily, I have a really good memory, so then I have it locked in my head. And at some point, I'll go in the studio and sketch or do a note or something about the idea.
Hmm.
But writing's different.
I do not have that memory, unfortunately. My mind is completely OCD. Everything just goes around and bounces all over the place. So I have to somehow mark it down. Now, the other side of that is I've realized that I can't stop those ideas from coming. So if I forget one, another one will come along. But
right,
I don't
get them all either. I don't get them all either. You know, but the project or the important things I am thinking about when it's more pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Thinking about that, those ideas, everything I have to write down and or concept sketch, because as you know, the project is pretty important. So that thing I really pay attention to. But I got ideas hitting me all the time, like we all do, these creative types. We've all talked about it. We've been talking, you know, asked questions by fans a million times. Where do you get your ideas? So
yep. That's true. Yeah, and I don't know what, you know, my response generally to that is, how can you stop them? I can't stop the ideas.
Well, I can't either. They come all the time.
Yeah.
I'm intuitive, by the way, in case you guys want to know.
Are you?
What's that? What was that?
I said I'm an intuitive person, by the way, in case you want to know.
There you go. Intuitive
for my stuff.
Harlan Ellison is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just sit down and go and see what comes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everybody finds their own particular expression. I want to say naturally. I mean, you've got to have certain guidelines or, you know, guide rails to keep you from going off the road. But I always have a problem with people who say, I can teach you to be creative. I just don't think you can teach someone to be creative. They've got that gene. Most people do.
Yeah.
But what they can
I
do is give you little guidances for releasing it.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah, I've heard that. I used to get so angry when I was acting, when somebody looked at me and say, oh, I can tell you're a good actor. And I'm like, no, you can't. You can't tell by looking at me I'm a good actor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I never understood that. And it happened quite often.
Yeah. That creative gene, you know, I get a lot of career questions and how you started and what were you like as a kid and did you draw and all that sort of thing. I have a kid of the 60s, and I remember from the earliest age, I had to watch every bad science fiction movie, every bad Hammer horror film. Twilight Zone, from the earliest age, I just had to watch them. I remember begging my mom to watch the show coming out on Friday night at 9 o'clock, a brand new TV show called Star Trek. And she let me stay up and watch it. Yeah, so that sort of stuff. So from the earliest age, my mind was quick. And I, you know, you guys were talking about my art and myself earlier, which is, you know, all flattering and embarrassing. But, you know, I get that a lot. Oh, you're so talented. But, you know, I come back, it's, you know, it's a lot of work. You know, I've seen my images from the 80s, and they're really bad, you know. So it's just that adage of 10,000 hours of, you know, you're a master of whatever it is you're trying to do. I think it's just a lot of hard work. But the one gift I might have is my imagination.
And that's also, you're finding the venue for your imagination. That's why I always say that commercializing creativity starts with that. First of all, you have to not think of it in the terms of commercializing it, but you have to think about expressing yourself, and you have to find the best way. For me, writing turned out to be the best way, and I put that in quotes for two reasons, only because I have no way to judge whether it's the best way. I just know that I love it, and people pay me. So somehow that comes together. But I wouldn't have gotten there if I tried to force myself into it. So I had to allow the creativity just to develop.
Which comes right back to your beginning, which I know, you know, you're coming to L.A. as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, so talk about that for a little bit.
Me?
The transition. Yeah, you. You're on the show as well. So the transition from, you know, that actor to a writer, I mean, that's fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, the somewhat short version of it, as many people who have heard me before, you kind of know the story, so just kind of like mouth the words along with me. I came out to Los Angeles originally as an actor, and I'd been doing acting since I was about 12 years old. My first paid professional performance was in the State Play of Florida, Cross and Sword, done at St. Augustine, about the founding of the city, and I played a 12-year-old kid named Jesus was my name, and I had a donkey, and I talked to the donkey. So, it was award-winning, if anybody had seen it. But that got my interest in acting, and I pursued that also in college. I got a degree in theater, and I came out to Los Angeles to be an actor. And I was doing okay, but I hadn't been out here very long before I started to meet casting directors, and I was becoming kind of friendly with them. They got to know me fairly well. It wasn't like they were casting me in a lot of things, but they apparently kind of just chatted with me. And they said they were tired of seeing actors coming in and auditioning with material they had seen before from plays and from TV shows. And so I just decided to start writing my own audition scenes. Those audition scenes became very popular. They were being used by other actors in showcases. And a casting director suggested I should write a script, which I first said, no, I can't do that, which was my first lesson in life. Don't say, no, you can't do that unless you've tried to do it. And so I thought I would write one. And I wrote a horrible script, just absolutely horrible. And it's, you know, like I said, I look back on that early stuff and I go, oh my gosh, this is a horrible script. The difference, though, is that I absolutely loved doing it. It was just so incredibly fun and wonderful and creative, and all the voices were in my head. I can't express how much joy there was in writing that script. And so merely out of a love for it, I decided to keep doing it. And eventually, through a longer story, I hooked up with a friend of mine that was working at the restaurant that I was working at, actor at a restaurant, and Bert Pearl. He also had the same passion for writing, and we started writing together. And very shortly, we ended up on staff on a TV series called Riptide with Stephen J. Cannell Productions. And that started my career. And some people have said, you know, did you give up on the acting? I say, no, I never gave up on the acting because I love acting. Acting is wonderful. I think it's incredible. I love it to death. And if you had something that you loved as much as acting, you would do it too until you found something that you loved a little bit more. Then you would go and do that. So it's not like I didn't like acting or I wasn't doing well in it. I just found this incredible area where I could express myself fully. And I still do the acting. As some of you may know, I actually have a performance coming up. We're going to start rehearsals of Macbeth, done by the House of Bards Theater Company. And that will be very interesting because I haven't done stage work in about 30 years. But I'll be playing King Duncan in that one. So it's kind of fun to go back to that. But again, it was...
I'm excited to hear that, Steve. I think that's cool.
I was surprised to hear about it. but what I kind of found is that, and this applies to artists of all mediums, what I realize is that I'm not a writer. And Jeff, you are not an artist. We are storytellers. We have messages. We have stories. We have things we have to relate. The key is finding the correct venue for you to do it. And you found it in art. You do it so well in art. I found it in writing. I still like to think I find it in acting as well. We'll find out in another month. But I think
as
that
I bleed,
everybody
as
who
I bleed,
isn't... Do what?
As I bleed over into writing. You know, that's...
Exactly. Same thing. Because of the reasons you're pursuing it is not necessarily because you are desperate and dependent upon it. It's because it's a new avenue of creativity and expression. So there's my lecture for today.
So why don't we go to the next topic, which is, you know, talking about, you know, your project. I don't know who wants to start off talking about it, but whoever would like to take the ball, I'm throwing it to you.
Well, this is Jeff's brainchild and his love child, and Jeff, take it, because I'm kind of honored to be a part of it.
Well, where should I start?
At the beginning.
Born in a small cabin.
Almost. I was coming back from a convention in Portland. I do demos at some of the shows. I do art demos, and I've been working on a piece I drug out of my studio I'd had for a while, dusted it off, took down there a big painting I was working on, and it was a floating city. Now, I'm an old world builder from the 70s. I played D&D way back when, which came in real handy later when I was building this world. As I was driving home from Portland back up to Seattle, my son was asleep in the back seat, and I do a lot of thinking on road trips, and I travel a lot to shows and cons, conventions. And it just hit me, you know, that where do the ideas come from? Hell, I don't know. It was just there, you know, a door slammed open, something shoved out this idea and slammed the door shut. I almost had to pull over. It came almost all at once. I've been studying a lot Yellowstone. I'm kind of an amateur guy when it comes to plate tectonics and volcanism and earthquakes and that sort of stuff. I was always been fascinated about it. And about that, during that time, I was really reading up a lot on supervolcanoes. And it just hit me that maybe Yellowstone goes off, and before it does, mankind lifts these cities up into the air to tap solar energy in the coming nuclear winter that will engulf the whole world for decades. That was the initial kernel of the idea. And it evolved into... I started doing a lot of concept drawings. I started doing a lot of paintings at the encouragement of Kevin J. Anderson and Peter Wax, who were shoving me to make this happen. Basically, I owe so much to those two guys, especially Kevin. And I started painting and drawing and creating these cities and writing the story, the backstory, and what we came up with. With a lot of help from John Pitts, by the way, who's one of the writers in the anthology. In 2085, scientists announced to the world that the supervolcano Yellowstone is going to erupt in 6 years, and when it does, it will be a full-blown eruption, and civilization as we know it at that time will be destroyed. This is about 60 years in the future, so there's much technology advancement in this scenario we've created, and one of them is anti-grav tech. So cities start being lit, and it had been in use for a little bit for the wealthy and the rich, but now countries and the military and churches, like the Catholic Church, all around the world, cities started going up, and people scrambling to get up on them. And the world turns into chaos. There's a lot of bad stuff that happens at that time. And then the volcano goes and the world goes dark. One of the things that is also built with that high tech of 2085 are dirigible airships made to last for centuries. And they are sold and passed around to those who can get them, fleets of them. Then we jump about three centuries later, and in all that time, what has happened with these cities? Many of them have connected up to form a trade loop. There are pirates, there are mutants, there are wars, there are, well, Stephen, your turn. You take it over from there.
And there are picnics, and there are birthday parties, and big bouncy castles. Well, what I like about this, and I was... Jeff, you and I either met because Peter introduced us or Kevin introduced us. I forget which one.
I forget too.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, we'll remember them both for it. This concept that you have, it kind of reminds me of there's a project which I'm not going to go into right now. Another project that I have, and when I pitch it, I spend about 10 minutes pitching the scenario, the universe that's been created, and people become fascinated, they're just incredibly fascinated by this other concept, and then I kind of stop the pitch and I smile and I say, you know, the funny thing about this is I haven't even told you about the story yet. I just told you about the universe. That's what's so captivating about this, the floating cities concept, everything you just talked about up to this point. The concept itself is so fascinating, and the reason it is so fascinating is because the moment you start talking about this world, you, Jeff Sturgeon, start talking about this world and the history behind it and what was created, almost everybody who has even an ounce of a storyteller's mind immediately starts seeing their own stories. That's a universe that has an accommodation for so many different stories within it that you don't have to stay in one location, you don't have to stay with one character. It is how do we react to that universe. And it's what brought me into it, because I just became totally fascinated with that idea. And I'm a bit of a technophile, and also as you and I found out, I also have my huge interest in technology, tectonic plate movements, and volcanology and archaeology included. So my mind starts combining all of those things and figuring out how humanity would survive and then try to rebuild from a situation like that. And it's never as simple as you would think, which means that it's incredibly complex, which is exactly what you've set up. And that's where the best stories come from. So the idea of these cities that are basically the result of an apocalyptic event, each one of them, I can go geek on this for hours, each one of them started out as a survival mechanism. They have now gone from a survival mechanism, basically we have to get together to survive, we have to work together to survive, but we're disconnected from the rest of the world, therefore our immediate community is all we are concerned about. Then that immediate community expands to where they've satisfied their defensive needs, their survival needs, and then they move to the next step, which is actually the trade needs. Now they begin to make contact, reconnecting with other establishments, other people out there. Then trade builds into alliances. Alliances build into politics. Politics will eventually build to war. It's like a recreation of humanity. And it follows a very logical time thread, a linear time thread, that all we have to do to understand is look in a history book. We've already done all this, but we're now having to do it again under this incredibly new circumstance. So each one of these cities is their own community, but they've had a chance to reinvent themselves with their own particular rules. So just imagine if the Vatican City was a floating city, and yet it did not have contact with the outer world for the longest time. What would they do? We had talked about centers of learning, the university center that would be built up, and that particular one is like the archive of all human knowledge. They're trying to protect it. Each one of these cities has their own particular focus. And so now we're talking about a time in this alternate timeline. We're hoping it's alternate. It won't be alternate if the Yellowstone Basin does explode. Now we're talking about a time where these cities have all made contact with each other. They're in the trade portion of their development, and they're just edging into the political area of their development, which means they are now not just trade competitors. They're becoming political and power competitors. So now, come up with any person you want. Come up with yourself. Come up with your neighbor and put them in that situation. You can write a story about that. Did I sound enthusiastic enough? Because that's how exciting this is. So the fact that, and the authors you have working on this are pretty amazing. The fact that you actually are including me is like awesome to an nth scale, if I may say so. I'm actually very excited about it. Jeff and I talked yesterday and got off on talking about one story that was just like, you know, as soon as we hung up the phone, I'm walking around the house coming up with all these different scenarios. It's pretty fun.
Well, we talked for 2 hours. I mean,
2 hours. It was supposed to be a 15-minute phone call.
That's how it works when we get off bouncing ideas.
Yeah.
No, I feel the same way about you and all these people that have just jumped on board. It's been crazy in that regard. I'm going to go down the list here real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yourself, Stephen, of course. David Gerald,
mm-hmm,
of Star Trek name. He's a very good friend of mine. He's working on the San Francisco story. Raven Oak, fabulous writer up here in the Northwest. Kat Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
He's an award-winning writer and president of Cephala. Jim Wright of Stone Kettle fame. Really happy to have him on board. Jody Lynn Nye, I believe she's doing Chicago, I believe. And a very, very good friend and a big supporter behind this project, Steve Perry. He has already finished his story. Andrea Stewart and Mike Resnick did a story, which is also done, set in Vegas City. Las Vegas lifted their own city up above Hoover Dam, and it is a wide-open, dangerous port city. So a lot of stories can happen right out of that. I believe Kevin J. Anderson is writing a story out of that, out of Vegas as well. Brenda Cooper, Peter Wax, John Pitts, who also helped me write the Bible being the backstory that the writers go off of, and where I develop and think and, you know, try to come up with everything I can think of to build the world, from geography to weather to creatures to everything I can think of. John was a big help with that. Danielle McPhail, she also ran my Kickstarter campaign, which funded in 48 hours, which was just crazy. Mm-hmm. She's one of the writers and ran a great campaign. And then Jennifer Brozak is and Manny Frischberg are my editors. And then we already have a couple of people writing stories for a second anthology, which we plan to do next year after we get this first anthology shipped out next spring.
Yeah. So, and this will be an anthology based on the obviously your artwork will be included in the anthology.
Yes.
Yeah.
In some of the limited edition of the backers are getting color plates in some of the books, but not all of them. One of the things we do plan on doing and probably long overdue is an art book. So it'll be something else on my plate.
Very
and
cool.
I have to create a bunch of whole new paintings now for some of these stories. So
mm-hmm.
Exciting.
And is there like a deadline when this is all going to be done and available to purchase?
Right. So the Kickstarter anthology funded in the beginning of June, and the backers get their copies by next spring. I think we're going to have them out by April or May, and that version of the anthology, of course, goes to the Kickstarter backers, and then we will have a commercial release of the anthology. And we're talking to publishers about that right now. My agent's talking to some people. I can't name names, of course, but there will be a commercial release of it as well.
Very.
And then we work on. And we go on to the second anthology, and also they want me to do a novel. So, yeah.
That's really cool. That one thing kind of spread out into about 10. That's really cool.
Well, for those who recognize the names that were flying past your ears there, that kind of, well, and that underlines why I'm excited about it, not just because I get to, you know, be in, have my name in with that particular mixture, but it also shows that this has charged the passions in those people. And, you know, you've got some pretty top authors working with this.
Yeah, I got a bunch of Hugo and Nebula people on here, which just, you know, I'm just humbled by it all, to be honest.
Well, you charge them up, dude.
Well,
so I'm really excited to read some of the other stories.
I am too. I've read Steve and Mike's, and it's very weird to read something in a world you've created. In fact, I was a little nervous about the whole beginning of it, having people actually come in. I wish I was a good enough novelist like you guys, a good enough writer just to write a novel myself, you know, to get everything in my head. So I was a little nervous having other writers come in at the very beginning, but I got over it pretty quick.
May I make a suggestion?
Sure.
I'm chatting with Sherry. How dare you?
I know. It's very rude of me. I was watching this thing about, you know, the big super volcano in the Sea of Naples.
Yes.
Yes, I did.
And that they were talking, I was watching a documentary and they were talking about Baia, which is like the sister city to Pompeii. And they were talking about that Baia is coming up in the ocean. It's sunk. It is gone. They're doing archaeological research, but it's actually moving up. They said there's so much magma underneath it that the actual lost city is moving up in the sea. Is that scary?
Well, they do breathe. up and down. That Yellowstone goes up and down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say one of the things that's kind of interesting about this, I mean, you talk about super volcanoes. A lot of people don't even understand that. They think Mount St. Helens was a super volcano. No, it wasn't. Mount St. Helens was a pimple. Despite all the devastation and the deaths, a super volcano is, this actually isn't fiction in the sense that if the caldera around Yellowstone went off, and it would go off with several, consider that it would be several plumes, meaning basically a whole bunch of volcanoes going at the same time within one caldera with a giant explosion. The scenario of almost destroying mankind is not really that far from fact. The climate change alone would be incredible. But when you consider that there are several of these around the planet, and also most people don't realize how concerned geologists have become in the past. At one point, the center of the caldera in Yellowstone tipped so much to one side that the geologists were convinced that we're just mere years away from this exploding. I mean, literally the entire lake tipped to one side.
Yeah, animals left the area, which also concerned them. But they've learned that supervolcanoes, active ones, and which Yellowstone is, it's not doing anything. But well, actually, it is. It has more geysers than any of the other geysers combined in the world there. So it's a breathing, living thing, and it breathes up and down. It moves up and down. You know, Mammoth Lakes is another one that people don't realize is a supervolcano.
That's right. Anybody who saw the movie Dante's Peak, that was actually based on a real event at Mammoth. Where it didn't go off, but all the signs leading up to it were pretty much the same.
Right.
So they evacuated
right,
the entire area. That was back in the 80s, I believe.
And
of course, living up here in the Seattle area.
That's the Sea of Japan, too, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's the Rim of Fire, certainly.
Living up here in Seattle, I'm looking at volcanoes all around me.
And we were talking about Mount Rainier yesterday, and that is, volcanologists put that very high on the list of American volcanoes as far as being the next one that might actually have a major eruption.
It doesn't even have to do much. It just needs to shake a little bit and melt a little bit of ice, and those towns right at its base will be in serious danger. It doesn't even have to blow. It just needs to come alive a little bit, and it's a danger.
It could start one vent on the southwestern side, melt all that snow that's up there and completely flood out the towns below it.
That's another thing that they were talking about the one in Naples, that they said that there's no way to get everybody out. There's no way. It's just there's not enough roads for all those people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Yeah.
We're down to about 3 minutes.
No.
My God,
minutes.
Really? Is that close? I thought it was going to be like decades before this happened. I was hoping for 1,000 years before the next explosion. You're saying 3 minutes?
I think he meant the show, not the explosion.
Oh, okay. Hold on. Let me put my dog down again and unpack my suitcase.
We still have 11 minutes.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Okay.
We're fine.
Yeah. Rest.
I keep my eye on
Calm
the
down,
time, Jeff.
Gotcha.
Yeah. By the way, as a little side note, I think it was the Captain and Tennille, the recording artist, a while back. Back in the 70s or 80s, when Southern California was going through a swarm of earthquakes. I mean, we just had a lot of them for 20 years. You had at least a 5 to a 6 point every year, and they had designed something. I'd heard this in the news that they had designed basically a system in their backyard, which was, if an earthquake hit, a major earthquake, it released a balloon and they would float above it. And because really that's kind of like the safest place to be during an earthquake. You can float up there and watch everything going on. Well, do that with an entire city. So here we are.
Oh,
sure.
My God. Did they really do that?
That
did
was what I read. Now, somebody should double check on that, but that's what I'd read. It was a Captain and Tennille, I believe. And people laughed at them, and I actually thought, that actually makes total sense. You know, the truth is,
it does make,
if you're in an earthquake, it's things that fall on you is what kill you. So if you're above it.
Well, it makes sense. It's just the imagery. It's just fried into my brain now.
I
was up on a balloon with the captain
oh
and his funny little hat, you know.
Yeah. But then again, that's
Thank
the other thing
that,
about this world that we hadn't mentioned. Keep in mind that these floating cities have preserved themselves by floating, and there's a big question of what's happening down on the ground, because that is changed as well. And that's a major
There was a lot of biological terrorism at before Yellowstone went. Things dropped into the to the water systems. So there are mer people that are pretty nasty. There are things on the ground that were once human that are no longer. Nevada and Area 51 is a constant bad thing for Vegas City. There's a ghost fleet that was once the military way back, and they have stealth ships that prey on all the shipping, and they scare the hell out of captains. The captains, a lot of their ships scavenge and salvage what they can from the ruins below, which is incredibly dangerous to help feed the economy of the cities. It's a very dangerous world.
Yeah. Everything changed on that day.
No, it sounds great. I'm just thinking about living in that kind of world. That's the yuck.
That's the point. And writing these stories, one of the crafts to it is that you write the story from the perspective of people who live it. In other words, a floating city is not exceptional to them. What they have to do to live in a floating city is just the day-to-day. But it is specifically their interaction with it that is so fascinating for me.
And now there's people on the ground now as well at that three-century mark. There's communities starting to be built, usually clustered beneath the cities, trying to expand some agriculture if they can. All very dangerous, of course.
Yeah. And all a very natural progression of what would happen to society with the caveats of having the floating city in the first place, that has to happen. But even your background on how those cities happened, tracing it back to the wealthy who could do it just because they could do it. And that's where the technology was developed. And then, you know, add on the centuries and centuries, and here we are.
Speaking of isolation real quick here, you know, I kept flashing on the Washington, D.C. Cities, which is three towers and the three branches of the government. And even then, they were close together. They were separate for some time. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're coming to the end. Jeff, what is your website so people can find out about this book when it comes out?
JeffSturgeon.com. And then on social media, we have JeffSturgeon.com.
Oh, okay.
www. On Facebook, there's Jeff, myself. There's the Jeff Sturgeon's Last Cities of Earth, which has tons of stuff on it, artwork of the cities, the news. You can go to Kickstarter. It's still up, and look at Last Cities, and it has all the authors and info on the stories and the backstory all on Kickstarter. Also, I have the art of Jeff Sturgeon on Facebook. I'm on Instagram as Jeffrey L. Sturgeon. So there'll be news of this all over the place. Besides, all the writers will also be talking about it. They already have been talking about it.
Yep.
Cool. And because we're closing up, Steve and Jeff both, do you guys have anything coming up that people can come to and say hi?
Jeff, go ahead.
You know, I've done so many shows. I did six of them last year and traveled 11,000 miles all over the web.
Wow.
I have to drive because the paintings are so big. This year, I've done my three shows I think I'm doing. I'm going to spend the rest of the year just painting and working out of my studio, though I think I will be at Oricon on that Saturday, November 12th. I think I'll be down there all day doing a few panels and having lunch with Steve Perry.
Cool.
So we can talk about them last
week.
So that'll be the only place you'll be able to see me, I think, at Oricon on that Saturday.
For me, I've let's see, I'm consulting on one pilot. I'm writing one pilot. I'm writing two books. I'm writing a collection of short stories on my own. However, my appearances are quite limited because of all of that, and especially because for the next 2 or 3 months, I'm just going to be completely involved in the House of Bards production of Macbeth. And you can look that up. It's very exciting for me. And those performances will start in October, I believe, and go through the first weekend of November. And that'll be down on the Redondo Beach area. But you can look up all the details on my website, StephenLSears.com. The L is important, one word, StephenLSears.com. Or just Google my name. You'll see pictures of me or my dog. And that's me.
And the dog's name is Julian.
And the dog's name is Julian, and he's sitting right here.
Hi, Julian.
Hi, Julian.
I want to thank you both for coming on the show and taking the time to come on. It sounds like a fantastic project. I want to buy one.
Yeah. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll think we can get you a free copy, I think.
There you go.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. I really appreciate it.
And for those
that.
Of you, by the way, who will be getting copies of this when it finally goes on sale for everybody, think about the conventions you're going to go to and get all of those authors to sign their chapters. That's
yes.
going to be one heck of a collectible.
Yes. That is super cool.
Thanks, Steve.
Very.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you both. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you.
We had fun. Steve, and it's also fun to talk to you, Jeff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Oh, loved it. Thanks, Sherry.
It was great. Take care, Sherry.
Thank you, and thank you for chatting with Sherry.